Welcome to This Is Money podcast. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me and editor Simon Lambert today is pensions and investments editor Tanya Jeffries. And coming up, a surge in acrimonious inheritance disputes is rippling across Britain. So could your family be heading to court next? Are fixed energy deals about to make a comeback, leading to the question, to fix or not to fix? Meanwhile, we've turned our thermostat down, skimped on heating and switched off the lights. So how much energy has it actually saved? Ask Simon. Also today, the state pension top-ups gridlock. Will savers be able to fill old gaps before the April deadline? And retiring in your 40s? Is it even possible? Don't forget you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
Don't forget, you can stay on top of what's going on in the markets by tuning in to the Digest and Invest podcast by eToro. Go to your regular podcast platform and listen on the go. Digest and Invest by eToro, the podcast for those interested in trading and investing.
But first, on your website, Tanya and Simon, you have the story of Clive, his sister Kath, and their stepmom's son from an earlier relationship. It's, alas, not a happy story, but just one case from a surge in bitter disputes about inheritances spreading across Britain. A record number are going through the courts, with challenges to the distribution of estates rising 37% in 2021 compared with 2019. But why should this be the case? Tanya, tell me about Clive.
This is a sad story, but it's not uncommon. It's a couple that married later in life and had several adult children between them, three in this case. They didn't keep their will secret. They, you know, explained what would happen. The surviving partner would leave everything to the three children equally, seemed to be the way they were going to go. But unfortunately, that does rely on trust and on the surviving partner, whichever one it was, not changing their will. And unfortunately, they did this. And you don't necessarily need to tell people. Well, you can avoid telling people if you've written them out of the will. And it seems that Clive, I believe names have been changed for this article, by the way, the first that Clive knew about it was when his sister noticed his father's old house had gone up for sale, at which point he realized his estranged stepbrother had inherited everything and was selling the family home. It's a really tricky one. They seem to have had wills that, as I say, relied on a level of trust that just wasn't there. And apparently the stepbrother was estranged. And I think doing that kind of thing when there's already strife in a family is a very tricky proposition. You're also relying on the surviving partner to be fair and to put other people's children ahead of your own. People do put their own children ahead of their own. They put them ahead of their siblings. They put them ahead of their friends. They put them ahead of everybody in most cases. And they think that that is fair. You can argue that yourself into thinking that is fair because you're favouring your own children, even if it's not fair. You can see how somebody's mind would work on that front, even though, in my view, it's wrong.
Simon, why are we seeing a greater number of cases go this way? Because for me, and I imagine from what I've been listening to Tanya say there, I find this really murky, really distasteful. You know, someone's died and you're fighting over their money like vultures and creating family strife for what? Money. Ugh.
Well, the first thing I'm going to do is blame my favourite culprit for every ill.
Bill Gates.
Every financial ill that affects this country. No, not Bill Gates. We're not doing conspiracy theory podcasts.
Oh, sorry, that was last week.
That was last week on the eggs. High house prices. That is the primary reason behind this. House price inflation. When the average house cost £100,000, that was a lot of money. But now that average house that used to cost £100,000 costs £400,000 and has grown far out of proportion to wages, people's other wealth, and so on, you start to run into the scenario where people look like they're going to inherit life-changing sums of money. And you can look at it from the perspective of greedy vultures circling the money, or you can look at it from the perspective of the wealth that has been built up in a family, perhaps by one person in that family who, in a situation, has remarried. And then you can feel as if your parent has done this, and there is a really strong desire to pass on wealth to your children. Why do people build up wealth? They build up wealth so they can have a nice life, and they can have a buffer and so on. But people continue to build up wealth way beyond that. And in fact, actually, many people in this country, particularly older people, don't spend anywhere near as much money on themselves as they should do. There are lots of people who don't have enough money. There are lots of people who can't leave any money to people. There are lots of people who don't live in parts of the country where house prices are totally bananas, like they are in other parts of the country. But there is a big chunk of people in this country who continue to accumulate wealth beyond the point where they're retired. And the point that then when that wealth is passed on, a real driving factor and the reason why inheritance tax is so unpopular, despite the fact that actually not that many estates incur it, is because of that idea of wanting to pass something on to your children. And that works both ways. So if you feel that your parent has worked hard and saved hard and built up this wealth through all their life, and then say, for example, you've got a mother and a father, right? Okay. The father dies first, which, you know, is just statistically more likely. The mother then gets remarried, and then she dies, and then the father passes it on to only his children and not to the original children. And you can see how a family would feel almost as if not only has the most recent parent to die been cheated from their wishes, which were clear in their will. They said, I want to, if you go first, it goes to me, and then I'll divide it equally. If I go first, they'll give it to you, and you divide it equally. Those wishes were clear. Those wishes are then changed afterwards. So they feel that, the most recent parent to die has been cheated out of their wishes, but also that the parent before that, perhaps before the remarriage, that they feel cheated out of it. And that's just one scenario. There's an infinite number of these scenarios. And actually, this is something that we've written about quite a bit in the past. And Tanya's done quite a bit of work on kind of inheritance disputes and disputes over wills and things like that, part of which is flagging to people, you do need to think about this stuff, because the problem is many people just brush this stuff under the carpet, and they don't like talking about their money, and they don't like talking about their will. Most people won't ever tell the beneficiaries of their will that they are the beneficiaries in their will, despite the fact that they have a strong desire to leave that person money. It would be much better to explain to people, to say, look, this is what is in my will. This is what I want to do, to bring all this stuff out into the open, because then it dramatically reduces the chances of problems further down the line. And we're also seeing this problem with mirror wills as well.
You left that hanging, Simon. Carry on.
Mirror wills effectively do what they say on the tin. One will mirrors the other person's will. So I go first, I leave it all to you, and then you divide it between these people in this way, perhaps equally. You go first, you leave it to me, I do the same. And it's an easy way of writing your will. And you speak to a solicitor or a will writer when you're writing your will, they'll ask you lots of questions about what you want to do. A really good one will start talking to you about the edge case scenarios, what about the worst case scenario? You all go at the same time, that kind of thing. What if your children are under the age of 18? Mm-hmm. Do you want them to inherit all of this money that they'll be able to get their hands on at 18? Do you want to limit them being able to get it after they're 18, perhaps by putting it into a trust? But then there are tax implications of putting it into a trust and so on. But the mirror will thing is simple, and people understand it, and they go, yeah, of course, no problems. But I don't know, maybe when you're making those mirror wills, you need to think very carefully about it, and also think very carefully about, are there any problems in my familial or otherwise situation that could occur in this? And I think that one of the other problems also is, because of the way that inheritance tax is structured, everything you leave to your spouse is free of inheritance tax, and then you can double up the allowances and so on, and then pass it on. It encourages people to make wills in this way. And I would not doubt that we are going to see more and more and more inheritance disputes, because the wealthiest generation ever to have lived is reaching the point where, statistically speaking, more of them are starting to die, more of them are starting to pass on their assets. And as I said, we're talking about a lot of money here.
Tanya, as Simon said there, you've dealt with a lot of inheritance cases, as it were. Talk to me from the human angle as to how terrible this can be.
Oh, people get incredibly upset about it. We get absolutely desperate letters sometimes. You know, I've had screeds of 2,000 words of huge bitterness, and things can get incredibly complicated. They can go on for years and involve lots of legal fees. Adding to what Simon said about house prices, obviously that is a major factor. But I think it's also the case that, yes, we've got the most wealthy generation reaching the age where they're dying now. But also the younger generations under it, they missed out on final salary, you know, pensions. They're too old to get the full benefit of auto-enrolment. They've often got huge caring responsibilities. Their finances are really squeezed. When I talk about caring responsibilities, I don't just mean elderly parents and so on, but also grandchildren. And I don't want to digress too much, but one of the reasons I think that a lot of older people have stopped work and are not going back into the workforce is because they're doing so much caring for the younger generations. So these people coming up are looking to an inheritance to solve a lot of their problems. And if that is taken away from them, that is not just, you know, an emotional turmoil. That is their, you know, their financial plans out the window. So that I think really plays into it too. There is a way to get around it, which is explained in the article. But basically, instead of things like mirror wills, when there's two people who married later in life and there's several adult children in play, this exact scenario with Clive and his family, you leave the surviving partner a life interest in the property. So that allows them to live there for the rest of their life, and at that point the property is sold and the proceeds are divided among the adult children. And if that is settled in advance, I don't know, there's a way around that. The adult children do get it divided equally between them, or whatever arrangement is set out in the will. So that is the solution, and you can actually set this up from the day of your wedding. If you are marrying later in life to somebody with adult children and you've got your own, you can set that so that the will, your new will, you write a new will, putting this into place from literally the day of your wedding, so that if you keel over the reception, it will be sorted. And I've done a case, you know, with a lawyer where somebody wrote it and obviously was well aware of all the problems and wanted to avoid this very scenario in advance, and that is the way to do it. And this is very important. If you get married, then you should revisit the will that you've already made. Get a professional to talk through your personal situation. And then if you wanted to leave something to a sibling rather than stepchildren, then they could explain to you, you know, how best to do that.
Simon, then give us some tips how families can try and avoid these disputes. I suppose it starts with, as Tanya says, the person who's writing the will. And I think it's about communication. That's what you were saying. If you are going to leave someone out of a will, or you're going to split things perhaps unevenly, the best thing is to have a conversation. The problem is, I'm very open about these things. Everybody who's in my will knows about it and exactly how much they're going to get. Not a lot. Apologies, everybody. But every time I mention it, I get accused of being really morbid.
Yes. And I think it's highly unusual for someone who's going to exclude someone from their will to phone them up and say, oh, I just wanted to let you know, I am excluding you from my will. No hard feelings, but, you know, I just don't want to leave you anything. Yeah, I know you're my child, but, you know, we just don't get on, do we? Just thought I'd make a quick polite phone call to say so. If you are going to exclude someone, it's a good idea to tell them. Actually, I'll tell you what is a good idea to tell someone is if you're going to do the thing where some people like the idea of jumping a generation, leaving it all to the grandkids rather than their kids. If you're going to do that, do tell your children that. Don't just leave it until then. Also, there can be scenarios where you can leave people money who don't need the money, which sounds a bit strange, but there is a scenario where you can leave your children, your adult children, who might be now in their 50s or 60s, your estate and feel that you should divide it up between your two children, for example. But your two children might already have an inheritance tax problem. they might live in an area of the country with very high house prices. They might be, you know, wealthy. They might be over the limit. And actually, it's, you know, it is the grandchildren in their 20s who would benefit more. And people feel, you know, there are lots of people who feel that it would be unfair not to give it to their children and to give it to their grandchildren, particularly perhaps if one of their children, you know, doesn't have children themselves or something like that. But that's another scenario where, you know, have that conversation. And it is actually possible to divert the proceeds of a will. If you inherit it and you decide that you don't want to inherit it, you can do something called a deed of variation. You could potentially divert that money to somewhere else. But a while back, when I did my will, which is not as long ago as it should have been, but it's now long ago enough that I comfortably was like, okay, I've done it. So we're talking like 7 years ago or something like
that. Listeners to the podcast will remember, long-term listeners, that, you know, right. I believed you for a couple of years.
Yeah, I wrote an article actually about what I found out when I wrote my will. And this is much more relevant to people of my generation, okay? So like I'm in my 40s, okay? I'm in my early 40s. So I've got kids, I've got a house, okay? And I've got some savings. So firstly, it's a good time to work out what you've got. You don't need an absolutely exhaustive list and the exact total value of everything you own, but it is a good idea to at least know the ballpark figure. And that means a rough total of all your assets, the value of your home minus the mortgage, any other property, if you have some, I don't, any savings accounts, investment accounts or products, anything else of value. Now, if you're married, a lot of those assets will be shared, but there will also be individually owned assets too, personal savings accounts, ISAs, investments accounts, and so on. And do write down where that stuff is so that if anything happens, your partner can find it. Because actually, lots of us are really, really bad at that, is that we've got accounts all over the show and nowhere have we written down where all those things are. So if anything happened, people would be like, well, I don't know where they've got accounts. I don't know where the money is. Also gather together any information on pensions and life insurance, right? Both your pension and your life insurance can sit outside of your estate. A pension automatically will do. And there are inheritance tax benefits to pensions as well. Life insurance, make sure it's written in trust, which means it sits outside of your estate and it can be paid out much quicker. Because that helps you understand how much money your partner would get, for example, if you did die, right? So if something really bad happened, how much money is my wife going to get? That's a really important thing to think. How much is she going to have that she's going to then be able to rely on, okay? And then there's also, you know, obviously there's the estate. And the basics are pretty simple, okay? You need a solicitor, you need a will writer. You can do this yourself. There are online services where you can do it. Some are much better than others. There's one called Fairwill, which is very good. But the basics involve, you know, who you are, what the will covers, details of your spouse, who you want to be your executors. You need to think about that and ask them if it's okay for them to be your executors. You can appoint professional executors, but they can charge quite a lot of money. So be careful about that. Okay, guardians for children under 18, trustees of any assets if you're leaving them in trust. So perhaps you don't want to leave your children money if they're under 18, you'd rather they wait and so on. You need to think about inheritance tax. Are you going to have an inheritance tax liability? Are you likely to have an inheritance tax liability in the future? If you are, then you need to plan for it. If you're miles away from it and you're never going to have one and you don't need to worry about it, and bear in mind, you know, double it up for a married couple and they can do £1 million free of inheritance tax, and most people this is not a problem for, then you don't need to worry about it so much. But do, you know, think about that. And then you need to think about some of that stuff, like the executors, as I just said. Who do you want them to be? Who do you want to look after your children if your children are under 18? Talk to them about that as well. Don't leave them that surprise. How are you going to provide for them? How are you going to make sure that your children, do you want them to continue in the same kind of upbringing and lifestyle? And so on? You can't dictate to someone what they should do, but you can express your wishes. Do you want to leave any legacies? And then there's the complicated stuff. What if you both die? What if something terrible happens and you're both on a plane and it goes down? You know, how do you provide for the children? How do you protect them? And then like the worst case scenario, what if it's all of you who go? I mean, maybe at come that point, you don't mind and it just diverts off to your families or whatever. And you need to think about, did you put in unequal amounts into houses and stuff like that? And then you need to make sure you sign your will, right? This is a classic mistake that people make. They do all of this stuff and then they don't sign the will. And also then tell someone where it is. Again, often a big mistake people make. They have a will. It's all fine. They die. Nobody knows where the will is. They don't even know who they wrote it with. They don't know the solicitors and so on. And in fact, this actually, funnily enough, happened with my grandmother. My nana made her will and I think she named my dad maybe as an executor, got him to help her out with it. But then my dad died before my nana, which she never expected to happen. And then when my nana died, we knew she had a will, but we didn't have the faintest idea where it was. We thought we were going to have to ring round solicitors in her local town and say, did you by any chance once make a will for, you know? And eventually we did track it down. We didn't have to do the ringing around solicitors, but there was a genuine real life scenario where we looked at this and went, well, we know there is one.
What happens in that case if you can't find one?
We don't know where it is. Well, you know, you can do various things to try and track it down. As I said, you can literally just start phoning around solicitors where you think it might have been made and so on. But there's no system whereby the moment you make a will, it's automatically registered on some central database and then you can just go search it up.
All right, then. Let's move on from that. Could we finally see the return of fixed energy deals? Let's go there. Experts say suppliers are preparing to bring back competitively priced fixed tariffs, potentially, Tanya, in a matter of weeks. Good news, no?
Well, yes, I it definitely would be good news if you could get a discount on it. The reason seems to be that the whole sell prices have been coming down. That does take a while to feed through to the actual prices that we pay. But also the government support is going to come down as well. And Cornwall Insight, who put out this prediction, seems to think that the providers are going to start looking to their competitive advantage again and may put out some deals. My feeling, though, is that they're going to go very cautiously to start with. I would not be surprised if the deals are not that good to start with. I mean, they don't want a big rush of people. There'd be a lot of pent-up demand. So they'd probably go very carefully to start with.
But Simon, if people think that they are going to come down further, will anyone get a fixed deal? So then you're going to inevitably have a rush when people actually do think that it's worth fixing.
Well, I think you just hit the nail on the head there, Georgie. So people are going to be looking at this. And so say, for example, and they're going to be quite tentative, aren't they? You would expect someone comes out with a fixed rate deal that's £200 cheaper than the energy price guarantee. Well, you're going to look at that and go, it's £200 cheaper. It's not bad. But that's less than 20 quid a month over the course of a year. Prices are coming down. What if someone offers one that's £300 cheaper soon, or £400 cheaper, or £500 cheaper? And so you might get people sitting on their hands and not switching. There's a bit of controversy as well in some of the Ofgem stuff that's come in recently about getting suppliers to compensate the old supplier in some way if people do switch, which people think might discourage some of this from going on. The suppliers that are left have had to, you know, they've had a bit of a bruising, so to speak, energy suppliers. Then energy suppliers are not making out like bandits on this one. People with large energy trading operations are doing very, very well. But if you look at Centrica, British Gas owner's results, Centrica's not making money from British Gas supplying you gas to your house. Centrica's making money from its international gas trading arm. How keen are suppliers going to be to do this? I don't think we're going back to the old system where it was switcherama and people running on minuscule margins, plug you in here, plug you on there, compete for the cheapest deal and so on. But it is good news that this may return. I think what will then raise its head is how quickly should Ofgem and the government start looking at changing the price cap and the energy price guarantee. Should that start tracking energy prices lower or are we going to hope for the best that the competitive market will sort things out?
Daniel, what do you think they should do?
Well, I think the price guarantee, the government will want to ditch it as soon as possible. I think people should prepare themselves for that. It does look like the wholesale prices are heading downwards, but I think that people should be aware that it's an incredibly volatile market, and then there's a really long time before it feeds through into what you actually pay. At the moment, because it's winter, the Ukraine war is at something of a stalemate, but it really looks like it could kick off again in a really intense way in the spring. Now, it might be that the energy shock that Russia's invasion will not be repeated because so many countries have wised up, got other supplies in place now. Nobody's relying on Russia anymore, not in the Western democracies anyway. You can see, can't you, that predicting prices in this market is just incredibly difficult. I think, though, that prepare for the government to wind down its help. I think get ready for that.
So I'm listening to Tanya there. I mean, it's so hard to predict what's going to be happening. We're talking geopolitics and all sorts here. You know, I just want to pay my energy bill and heat my home. Is there a more elegant solution that we could employ?
I would imagine that there are many, many more elegant solutions that we could employ than the current energy market system in the UK, which turned out to be a busted flush. We thought we'd solved the problems of the big six with all this competition that came in, and actually we had just created another problem somewhere else. I think that over the coming years, we're going to see a look at how we might do this better. We're probably going to see talk of things like district heating and so on, you know, sort of collectivizing it more rather than it being a very individual scenario, which is the way our energy market works at the moment. But I think everybody involved in the energy market, including, you know, Ofgem, the regulator, and the government and the energy department, are largely just hoping that we can get through the energy spike, price spike, the energy crunch triggered by the war in Ukraine and all those other things, and then that they can start thinking about this another time.
Let's stick with energy, but your article, you turn down your thermostat to 18 degrees. Mine's on 19 and I'm freezing. I think I've broken mine. But anyway, skipped on heating and switched off the lights. So how much energy has it saved, Simon Lambert? That's the question you've been asking.
This was my column this week. Mm. And I'm going to preface this with two things. One, this was an extremely unscientific test. It involved looking at 1 month's bills this year and 1 month's bills last year. There has been nothing that's literally the most scientific thing in there, covers the same period, right? Secondly, I thought I made this abundantly clear, but I'm not sure from some of the comments on the article. The heating isn't permanently on at 18 degrees C, right? Okay. It's on a timer. Right. It only comes on for a few hours of the day. Yeah. And when it comes on, the thermostat is set to 18 degrees C. Okay. So there was a little misunderstanding. I think there was a misunderstanding from some commenters that we were just permanently sitting in an 18 degrees C temperature, which isn't that warm. But also, you know, and there is this theory that you might be better off just leaving your heating at a constant temperature and then so it doesn't fluctuate so much. According to the Energy Saving Trust, that's not the best way to do it. They say the thing where you have it on a timer and it comes on when you need it, that's the best way to do it. But I wrote about this, led to 1,600 comments on the article yesterday, of which about 1,557 are people arguing about what temperature your thermostat should be at, ranging from people saying it's inhumane to be having to be thinking about setting it at 18 degrees Celsius in this day and age, to other people going, well, mine's at 13, mine's at 9, mine's at 8. I mean, what's the point of setting your thermostat to 8 unless you live in an igloo? I mean, it's not going to come on, is it? And actually, funnily enough, the World Health Organization, the government and the Met Office all recommend a minimum thermostat temperature for winter of 18 degrees C. That's the lowest they recommend. It used to be higher. That is now the lowest that they recommend. Obviously, if you are fit and healthy, you can definitely probably get away with having it a bit lower, but that's the one they recommend for everyone. But going back to this, okay, energy prices. Yeah, they're really high at the moment. Energy bills, they're really expensive. We live in a detached house, but it's not a particularly big detached house, but it was built in the 1960s. It's not very well insulated. We have double glazing, but it's very old, and almost every single double glazing unit has failed. Now, the long-term answer would be to properly insulate our house, do the double glazing and all these other things. The reason why we haven't done this in the 2.5 years since we moved in is because at some point we plan on renovating this house and extending it, which we can't afford to do at the moment. But at that point, we will do all of this stuff. But it would seem very silly to do all of this stuff and then potentially unpick it. And that stuff is expensive and it takes a lot of money, time to get it back. So as it is, beyond some basic measures, we're stuck with what we've got. But in reaction to higher energy prices, like many other comfortably off households in the UK who had never worried about their energy bills before, we have been spurred into action. Kind of half-assed action, I will admit, but we have been spurred into action. The thermostat has gone down to 18 degrees C. It was previously set at 21. In my defense, it's not the world's most sophisticated thermostat, and you do have to set it slightly higher than you would think you need to set it in order to actually get the heating to kick in when you want it to kick in. We have also pared back the hours that the heating is on. It has definitely been, the timer has been reduced. And also we have been reaching for the override button a lot less this winter. We've been toughing it out, putting on an extra jumper, putting on a body warmer, sitting under a blanket, not all the time, but, you know, like in the evenings when you're watching TV and you might have reached for the heating before. Now you put a blanket over you, kind of thing. Common sense, you may say, but there's lots of people who haven't been bothering to do this in the past because they didn't need to. Lights. Me and my wife have been wandering around this house turning lights off all the time. Again, she's better at this than me. But I have stopped doing mood lighting in rooms I'm not in, for example. Well, the light looks nice. The room looks nice with the lamp on. So when you walk in there, it looks nice. We don't live in a hotel. We don't need to set things up like that. If you're not in the room, turn the light off. I've also been walking around turning the lights off behind my children, who aren't bad at doing it themselves. Mm. But there is a tendency to suddenly discover that half the lights in the house are on. And then also we've been doing, you know, whatever else we can, like trying not to use stuff so much. Even the precious tumble dryer has been getting a bit less of a spin. So what good has that done us? Well, I looked at my bill from the 13th of January to the 12th of February. And between the 13th of January to the 12th of February, we used 346 kilowatts hours of electricity and 3,378 kilowatt hours of gas in 2022. Mm. In 2023, we used 308 of electricity and 3,075 of gas. This was good news because there was a slight concern that I was going to look at this and discover that despite all these efforts, we'd actually managed to use more energy. And then I was just going to give up. Yeah. So our electricity usage is down 11% and our gas usage is down 9%.
Right.
Not really shoot the lights out stuff, is it? For all those times you thought, oh God, we would have just put the heating on last year or in the past. But there has been a bit of fatigue of the I'm chilly nature. There's been some slippage on switching the heating on over the past month. I am the main culprit there, I should say. And also, I think that it has been colder over the last month than it was over the same period in 2022. And it's difficult to measure because it's middle of month to middle of month. But the Met Office statistics appear to back that up. Doesn't make a huge difference, though. A year ago, our projected energy bill for 12 months was £1,885. And now our projected bill for 12 months is £3,647. But it helps. It's slightly less than we were spending. You know, but hopefully those prices are going to come down. I reckon I'd give us a 7 out of 10 for effort and attainment.
Well,
you know, not bad. We have reduced it, but could try better. But it does go to show, actually, that, you know, unless you were really, really militant about this stuff, it can be quite hard to really drag things down with some of the behavioral change stuff. And it is the more long-term things, the insulation, the making your home much more efficient, that will really pay off.
I think 10% is pretty good, though. An average of 10% reduction is not bad.
Yeah,
so knock it, Simon. You did well. You did well.
I don't know. I think with the gas, I would have expected that turning the thermostat down to 18 and having the heating on less would have delivered a bit more of a result.
Maybe there's someone in the house sneakily going around and putting it up without telling someone.
The cheeky heater.
Do you know what I mean? Maybe. Or maybe your thermostat just needs changing. Who knows? But will it change? The question is, will it change your habits going forward, do you think, Simon? Do you think this shock that we've had, and hopefully it will be over soon and prices will come down, but do you think this shock will have shaken us into a bit of action? I'll ask Tanya that. Tanya, do you think that? Have you changed your habits? You seem very sensible.
They're
in a big jumper.
Well, this year I am. I'm going to confess that in years gone by, I would back the heating up and wander around in a T-shirt all winter. I know. 21, 22 on the thermostat. It's been a steady 20. It's been a steady 20, not as good as Simon's, but I felt that that was, you know, that I was still doing my bit. And I had it on less a lot. Usually in the autumn, I will start turning it on the moment I start feeling chilly. And I did hold out and put fleeces and jumpers on during the autumn. I don't know what's gone on with my bills, though. I didn't seem to get a bill. So I actually rang up my provider and said, what's going on? And they said, oh, you're £280 in credit, madam. What? Mm. I mean, it's good news, obviously, but how did that happen? I mean, they must have, you know, overcharged me at some point and I just paid the bill. But at least I can sit back and not worry about it for hopefully a couple of months. And by that time, we'll be in the spring and the heating will go off anyway. I'm pretty good about turning the heating off in the spring. I just tend to turn it on early in the autumn. In terms of whether my habits will change, I think I will be better in future. Having done this winter at a lower temperature, I think my habits will change. I mean, it's good for the environment as well to, you know, to use less energy. And so I will try and stick with it. If the bills are cheaper, it will probably slip a bit, I'll have to admit.
All right, then. That's it for part one.
Don't forget, you can stay on top of what's going on in the markets by tuning in to the Digest and Invest podcast by eToro. Go to your regular podcast platform and listen on the go. Digest and Invest by eToro, the podcast for those interested in trading and investing.
Welcome back. Savers wanting to buy state pension top-ups before the crunch April deadline are struggling to get through to DWP, prompting calls for the deadline to be extended. This is money readers are complaining that the phone lines are jammed and can't get through. And if they do manage to actually reach someone, staff on the other end of the call can't give them crucial information they need to make the right decision on whether it's worth paying voluntary national insurance contributions. Tanya, firstly, what's the April 5th deadline? What's this story about?
The deadline is of importance because you can usually only buy state pension top-ups going back 6 years. But at the moment, there's a special concession which allows you to fill gaps and buy years going back to 2006 to 2007 financial year. So if you've got gaps in those years, it is a really good time to fill them. And a lot of people are rushing to do so, hence the frustration if they can't do so. The reason for doing it is actually a really good deal. You are taking a gamble because you may not live to see the benefit, but it doesn't take very long to actually come out ahead. If you buy a whole year at the moment, it's about 825 quid, 824, I think. If you work it out as you need 35 years to get a full state pension, each year you buy is 135th of that. So it works out at roughly 275 a year. Less than 4 years, you're going to have got back that £824. So when you're trying to work out how long you're going to live and make the most of this, if you're a healthy person, then it's not really a major head scratcher of a decision. Mm. It's very probably going to be worth your while. And obviously, it really adds up over retirement. Steve Webb, our pensions columnist, has done the number crunching on this. Over 20 years, you're looking at £4,400 net of basic rate tax for an initial outlay of £824 for 1 year. It can be less than £824 if you've got a part year and you've got some, you know, months where you paid national insurance and some you didn't, which is very common because, you know, people have career breaks, they take holidays, they do all sorts of things, especially in their younger years, which means that they're not working and paying national insurance that entire year. So it is quite common to have gaps. So in terms of what's been happening recently, we've done all sorts of advice on buying top-ups, and I'll explain, I can explain it in more detail, but Steve has actually got a very handy website tool which helps people decide whether it is worth it in their personal situation to buy top-ups, because which ones you buy is of great importance. But in the questions he's been getting to his column, we have certainly detected rising frustration and concern from readers. We've been getting more and more messages saying, I'm trying to get through, I can't get through. I've spent 16 hours, presumably not all in one go, trying to get through to the DWP and I can't. And when I do, people say they can't help me, or they give me different advice from what I got last time. Or several people said that they were getting through to a phone menu and then it was just cutting them off, which is very, very frustrating. If you've held on for an hour and then you get through and you're cut off, I mean, that would make anybody mad, really. Mm. So we decided it was time to write a story, because this deadline is looming. And if people can't get through and discuss their personal circumstances, then they're not going to know which years to buy. And it's very easy to make mistakes. You can get a refund, but obviously, if you're, you know, spending that amount of money, you don't want to be trying to claw it back later. So you can understand why people are getting anxious ahead of this deadline. And you also have to bear in mind that this top-up system is run jointly between the Department for Work and Pensions and HMRC. And the DWP will help you with the calculation, whether it's worth your while, through their Future Pensions Centre. But HMRC takes the money and actually does the processing. So you might also need to contact them as well to get to the other side of this. It's a great big palaver often for people, even when they can get through on the phone and talk to somebody. And it's probably going to ramp up as more and more people try and do this ahead of the April deadline. I should think we're going to get even more readers writing in about it.
Is the upshot of this just extend the deadline?
Well, Steve Webb commented for this story, and he thinks they either need to really pile resources on to get as many of these people processed as possible before the deadline, or they need to extend the deadline. Obviously, you can't extend the deadline forever, but when they set it, when they gave offered this deal and set a deadline, they must have realised there would be a rush towards the end. And we've talked on this podcast many times before about the problems not only getting through to DWP, but also getting the right help at the right time. The filtering system of getting your inquiries dealt with is charitably poor. And in this scenario, you probably need people who are qualified on top-ups, quite a lot of staff just dedicated to that, and a phone menu where if you press top-ups on the menu, you get through to someone who literally can explain to you what happens in your personal situation. It is very easy to make a mistake about this, because unfortunately the state pension system has changed a lot over the years, especially in 2016 when there was a huge reform of it. And it's easy to make mistakes and buy top-ups and then find it doesn't do anything to your state pension and then have to get a refund.
Tanya, thank you very much. Now, for many, not us because we love our jobs, but for many, an early retirement is the dream. But scrimping and saving your way through young adulthood to achieve it by your 40s is the reality, and not a very appealing one. The FIRE, we've spoken about it on the pod in the past, the Financial Independence Retire Early movement, has captured many people's imagination, but the extreme tactics of its ardent followers require a lot of discipline. But is it really feasible and even desirable, especially if you have kids? Simon, just to recap, what exactly is FIRE? Where did it come from?
It's this idea of absolutely skimping and saving as much as possible in order to provide yourself with financial independence, meaning that you have a pot of money built up that you could then invest and live on, financially independent, potentially retiring early, but also in some scenarios, not retiring entirely, but working on your own terms. It's basically about living on your own terms, about the, I don't have to go and do some work for someone if I don't want to do it, and I don't have to do any work if I don't want to, for example. And the idea is that you earn and you live frugally, you cut your expenses to the bone, and then you invest sensibly, not, you know, kind of wild trading investing, because actually that's quite often the shortest route to having a smaller pot of money rather than the larger one, with the goal of being done ASAP. And it sounds extremely tempting in terms of the ultimate goal. Who wouldn't want to be financially independent and have the choice to retire early? However, the method, I don't think is something that many people could do, because it does require a lot of sacrifices.
Tanya, talk me through them.
The sacrifices are quite extreme. Obviously, you tailor it to your own personal situation, but one of the goals is to save 70% of your income. That is a huge amount of your income to save. And as Simon said, you need to be extremely frugal. Other things that they suggest that you could try is any purchase you make, work out how many hours you had to work to afford that thing, to stop you on your tracks, basically. You can also do things like, you know, have a credit card, but always obviously pay it off every month. That's good advice anyway. And then use all the, you know, the points and rewards to the absolute max to make the most of them. Another one is when you get a pay rise, don't spend it, save it. Yeah. So carry on living at your old, you know, do the things that you used to do rather than...
lifestyle creep, I think they call it, don't they?
Yeah, yes, exactly. Another thing as well, which can be quite controversial really, is invest aggressively. I mean, that means taking a lot of risk, which means that your investments are going to be quite volatile. And you need to be prepared for that. And it depends on the time frame. I think investing aggressively, you can certainly come out ahead by doing that, but you might have some really big swings along the way. And you have to be the kind of person that is going to look at a 20% fall in the value of your portfolio and go, well, I'll make it up next year or the year after. I'll be ahead in the end, and be able to tell yourself that and still be able to sleep at night. There's no definite program that you have to follow. You can mix and match all these things to suit you. But obviously, at the extreme end, you're looking at quite a difficult young adulthood, an early middle age, where you're really missing out on an awful lot of stuff. I mean, let's be realistic. Having an enjoyable life does involve spending some money. It's not everything, but it does involve some outlay. And if your friends are all earning and spending a certain amount of money, and you keep saying no to everything and staying in, you're missing out on an awful lot. And quite a lot of the experts we've consulted for these stories, it's not the first one we've written on this movement, say, you know, you might retire at 40, look around, all of your friends are, you know, working really hard, looking after their children, trying to get them, you know, into university, trying to do all sorts of other things. You've got no one to spend your time with. I do think you have to weigh up what you're going to miss as well as what you're going to gain if you're going to think about doing it.
Should we take the approach that you took perhaps with your energy and just downshift it maybe like 10%, or, you know, save a little bit more, retire a couple of years earlier rather than a full couple of decades earlier?
Not be too militant about it. Yeah, that's always a possibility, isn't it? Yeah. I mean, I for one, definitely buy into a lot of this stuff, but also at the same time, I think I probably couldn't live as frugally to do it as this requires. However, what I would very much like to do is, once my children are 18 years old and have gone off to university and aren't my responsibility anymore, I'd like to move to the mountains and go snowboarding hopefully I'm still young enough and healthy enough to enjoy it, rather than waiting until my mid-60s.
Danny, just one question, a practical question, I suppose, is in terms of your aggressive investing and all that sort of thing and where you put your money, I guess for the fact you can't take your pensions out until you're in your 50s and your 60s, you're going to have to find another vehicle. Do they still save into pensions? Is that part of the FIRE movement?
Well, you certainly should, because of the tax relief. And if you've got an employer, the free employer contributions into your pot. And if you do retire early, you're going to miss out on a lot of that. But yeah, you do have to think about ISAs. Obviously, you can get a lifetime ISA that you can access a bit earlier at 60. The state pension age obviously looks like it's going up. It's, you know, going to be 67 by the end by about 2028, and it might go higher, as we've discussed on previous podcasts. But the age when you can take your private pension is also going to go up around 2028, and it's going to go up from 55 to 57. So you do have to do quite a lot of planning. The FIRE movement have got this system where you save 25 times your annual expenditure, or 33 times if you're going to be a little bit more conservative and have a bit more room to play with, and then you draw down 4% of your investments a year thereafter. I mean, this is real rule of thumb stuff, and obviously you might need a lot more than that, and drawing down 4% of your income may not be viable. There's a lot to think about. I suspect that there's not many people who can really go for this in an extreme way, but it's worth knowing about, and it's worth maybe employing some of the strategies to maybe get there a bit earlier.
There's questions about whether you can do it, you know, especially if you're on lower incomes. Yes, it's all very well and good agreeing with some of the principles, but is it a moral? I'm not sure if moral is the right word to use, but you know, if you have kids, is it really the right approach?
I personally don't think you should be doing this if you have children, because you're inflicting it on them for your dream of retiring early. And you're not just doing yourself out of all those life experiences, which cost money. You're doing them out of things that you could easily afford for them, but you're not giving to them. One of the experts we consulted, you know, pointed out that children are called dependents for a reason. They are dependent on you. You're responsible for them. You're responsible for their well-being, and you're also responsible for their development as well. And if you're denying them everything that all their friends can have that you could otherwise afford for them so that you can retire early, I really don't think that's fair. And I also think that there's a possibility with FIRE that you can get it wrong, that you would end up in retirement quite badly off. You could run out of money. And at that point, who would you then turn to? Your children, who you denied things in their childhood? Good luck with that. Look, it is a moral decision. I've obviously come down very hard on one side of it, which is that you shouldn't do it. There are arguments for doing it even with children. You can teach them a lot about budgeting and about deciding whether they really need something as opposed to whether just because, should they have it just because they want it. Obviously, every family is going to take a different stance on that. But my really quite strong feeling is, do not do this to your children.
You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions for the team or anything you'd like them to look into, Simon?
You can email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk. You can tweet us at thisismoney. And you can come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast to find all podcasts past.
And if you like our podcast, why not rate us wherever you found us? It helps other people find us too.
Don't forget, you can stay on top of what's going on in the markets by tuning in to the Digest and Invest podcast by eToro. Go to your regular podcast platform and listen on the go. Digest and Invest by eToro, the podcast for those interested in trading and investing.